You can go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel chapter number 9. 1 Samuel chapter number 9. When we first came to Westwood Heights, it was in 2004 in March, so we've been here about 14 years. And I was just shy of 11 when we started coming here. And back then, the children's church used to be in the basement, and it was usually, you know, Mr. Brown or Mr. Uralmick or Dave McCoy. But this one time, it was Dan Williams. And so Dan's preaching and leading the songs. And then towards the end, he says, well, I'm going to go around and let a few people say their favorite book of the Bible. So he goes around, a couple kids say their favorite book, and he says, well, we only have time for one more because I got to dismiss you. And so all the kids are going, oh, pick me, pick me, pick me. And so you look around, and he walks to the end of the table, and there with her arm up in the air and her little hand raised, he says, is first grade Daubry. And he says, Miss Nelson, do you have a favorite book? And she says, David. And Dan says, good choice, that's my favorite book too. And I remember as a kid thinking, what? We've been raised better than that. But I suppose 1 Samuel is my favorite book, which is what we're going through in my Sunday school class. So if you have any questions about tonight, just ask a junior higher and they'll be able to fill you in. But when Pastor said, oh, I'd like you to preach, I said, is there anything you want me to talk about? Or I said, I'm going through 1 Samuel, what do you think about that? And he said, I would suggest you do something you're kind of familiar with, so that's where we're going to be. He gave me some pretty good advice. He said, you know, Bradley, you don't need to reinvent the wheel, it just needs to be the Word of God. And I thought, well, that's pretty good advice. So that's what we're going to try to do tonight. And so I've entitled tonight's lesson, King Saul, A Life Worth Examining. And I think so often we hear King Saul and we instantly think of this wicked king who lived a bad life and it was this big tragedy. But I think it was an interesting life because, as many of us know, it wasn't always that way. And there's really three theories about Saul's salvation. And one, of course, we would give no credence to. One is that he was saved early in life and that he just fell away from the Lord as his life continued. And then the next one is that he was never saved and he died an unbeliever. And the third one is that he was saved and he fell away from the Lord and that he lost his salvation. And of course, we would reject that. So that leaves us with really only two. He was either saved or he wasn't. That's not my goal tonight, is to figure out which one it is, because at the end of the day, the Bible just doesn't say. But good people fall on both sides, and so that's okay. I think, you know, it's not a huge deal, but there's still lessons you can learn no matter which side of the coin you fall on, saved or unsaved. I still think there's a lot we can glean from his life. But the first thing is, it's sad that you even have to ask the question. And that's what I was telling my Sunday school class. I was encouraging them, and I said, hopefully when you guys and all of us, when we get older and when someone looks at us, they can say, without a doubt, that person loved the Lord. You know, that person lived a life, you know, for the glory of God. And they won't have to say, well, they had some good points in their life, but there was a lot of downsides as well. Hopefully they'll just know that person, you know, their life was for the Lord. But we're going to start and we're going to look at some commendable traits that I think Christians can take note of. We're going to start here, and we're actually going to be in several different places, but I'm going to read verses 3 through 10 in 1 Samuel chapter 9 to begin. And it says, the asses of Kish, Saul's father, were lost, and Kish said to Saul his son, take now one of the servants with thee, and arise, go seek the asses. And he passed through Mount Ephraim, and he passed through the land of Shalisha, but they found them not. Then they passed through the land of Shalim, and there they were not. And he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they found them not. And when they were come to the land of Zoph, Saul said to his servant that was with him, come and let us return, lest my father leave caring for the asses, and he take thought for us. And the servant said unto him, behold, now there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man, and all that he saith surely come to pass. Now let us go thither, peradventure he can show us our way that we should go. Then said Saul to his servant, but behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is spent in our vessels, and there is no present to bring the man of God. What have we? Verse number 8, and the servant answered Saul again and said, "Behold, I have here at hand the fourth part of a shekel of silver that I will give to the man of God to tell us our way." Skip down to verse 10. Then said Saul to his servant, well said, come, let us go. So they went unto the city where the man of God was. And so right off the bat, I think there's some things here that Christians can take note of. In verse 4 and 5, we can see Saul's obedience. His father says, pick a servant and go find a herd. And that's exactly what he does. And he looks diligently. He's not a lazy slug. He doesn't waste his time. He doesn't look in one place and give up. It says he looks through Ephraim and Shalisha and Shalem and Zoph and the land of the Benjamites. So we get this idea of Saul that he's not lazy. He's not easily deterred. And in verse 20, it says, you know, he looked for 3 days. I think that's commendable. He's a hard worker. In verse 5, we can see that Saul's considerate towards the worries of others, in this case his father. He says, look, my father's worrying about the herds already. We've been gone long enough. He's going to start worrying about us, so we better get back. He's mindful of others. Verse number 6, we can see Saul's humility. If you go by first verse 1, it says his father was a mighty man of power. So I think you can infer from that Saul grew up in a pretty prominent home, but he's not too haughty and too prideful, at least in verse 6, to consider the advice of a servant. He doesn't say, hey, I'm the master, you're the servant. You don't advise me, I advise you. On the contrary, he heeds his advice, and he says, you know, let's do that, let's go. And then in verse 7, you know, he's respectful towards the labor. He doesn't want a handout. He says, we've got nothing to give this guy. And he realizes that the labor is worthy of his reward. So right off the bat, I think there's some things there that we can look at the life of Saul and say, yeah, you know, that's something that I, you know, that ought to be said about me. You know, he's got humility and he's respectful. Turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 10 now. 1 Samuel chapter 10. And we're going to read verse 6, 7, and 9. And these next points that we're going to look at about Saul aren't necessarily character traits, but as Christians, I still think they're worth pointing out and taking notice of. So 1 Samuel chapter 10 and verse 6, and it says, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, talking about Saul, and thou shalt prophesy with him, and thou shalt be turned into another man. And let it be, when these things are come unto thee, that thou do as occasion serve thee, for God is with thee. And in verse 9, and it was so, that when he had turned his back to go from Samuel, Saul gave him another heart, and all those things came to pass that day. And so in verse 6, you know, you see, Saul was turned into another man, and all those things came to pass. He's a changed man. And this is the idea of a drastic change, a 180-degree turn. It's that same word when Moses threw his rod down and it turned into a serpent and ate up the Egyptians. It's the same idea there, something very drastic. Well, as Christians, that ought to be something we can say about our own lives, right? We teach the kids that song. There's been a great, great change since I've been born. Well, it appears in verse number 6 that there was a big change in Saul's life. In verse 7, it says God is with him. And the first few times I read that, I think it's really easy to gloss over. But as you go through the book, I think that's an underrated statement, because it's a different story when God's not with Saul. And then in verse 9, it says, and God gave him another heart. Again, as Christians, that ought to be something that we can say about ourselves. Hey, God's given me a new heart. I am devoted to serving the Lord and seeking his will. Verse 6, it says, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee. And in verse 10, it says, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. And so what we're seeing here is we're seeing a man of being used by the Lord, being used by God. And you don't have to turn there, but it's verse 7 right here. Or I guess it's in chapter 9, verse 7. We can see that Saul's been chosen by the Lord to be king. And what's his response to that? But I'm just of the small tribe of Benjamin. There's a level of humility there. He says, I'm just of this little group of people. How am I going to be king? And then in chapter 10, verses 21 through 22, it might not be the most admirable response, but when they're looking for Saul to make him king, he's hiding among the stuff. And it seems that he's shortfall of his mind comings, and he's mindful of his shortcomings, and he doesn't want the spotlight to be on him. And I think that's admirable, because some of us, we like being in the spotlight. But at least at this point in his life, that's not Saul. In chapter 10, skip down to verse 26. We're going to read verse 26 and 27 of chapter 10. It says, and Saul also went home to Gibeah, and there went with him a band of men whose hearts God had touched. But the children of Belial said, how shall this man save us? And they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. You can see Saul keeps good company. It says he went with a group of men whose hearts God has touched. That ought to be the kind of close company that we're keeping. The people who are influencing and affecting our lives, as God touched, he has moved in their lives. And then we can see that he's not looking to pick a fight with the children of Belial. He's their new king. They need to honor him. And what do they say? How's this man going to save us? And they despised him. But Saul, he doesn't take the bait. He doesn't go in. He doesn't say, oh, let's get rid of these guys. He holds his peace. And sometimes I think that's the best thing we can do. We won't read all these verses, but in chapter 6, it says the Spirit, or in chapter 11 in verse 6, it says the Spirit of God again came upon Saul. And in the following verses, the children of Ammon are getting ready to attack the Israelites in a certain city. And Saul, he has a desire to help those people of God. And he says, no, we're not going to put up with that. Let's go and let's help them out. And he keeps his word. He's a man of integrity. They go and they help that city and they defeat him. And what does he do at the end when they've been given the victory? He says, he not only realizes, but he vocalizes, God wrought the victory in Israel. And that's an admirable response. He realizes it wasn't his doing, it was the Lord. And then also in chapter 11, verse number 13, we can see that Saul is merciful. When those children of Belial, who we just read, they despised him, everyone now, after this victory, says, hey, who are those guys who said that, who's Saul? Can he lead us? They say, who are those guys? Let's track them down and kill them. And Saul says, hey, we don't need to do that. The Lord brought a victory in Israel today. And I think that's an admirable response. He's merciful. So we can see a man that in many ways, I think, is relatable to what we ought to be. He's respectful and he's humble and he's been given a new heart. He's merciful. He gives the glory to God when God deserves the glory to be given to him. But unfortunately, we have the other side of the coin, which is the part of Saul's life that's been riddled with problems. And I think as you go through and you look at Saul's life, it's easy to criticize him, deservedly so at many times. But as I was reading it, I thought, man, there's so many times where Saul does stuff that I thought, easy to look back now and say, man, I wouldn't have done that. That was dumb. I would have done something different. But it's not always that simple. It's not that easy. When you look at Saul, what do we were taught as kids in a way, that he was an evil, wicked king, and that's kind of how it ended, but it wasn't always that way. When I read a book or I read a Bible story, I watch a movie, I tend to do one of two things. I put myself as a background character, and I think, what would it be like to watch this unfold? But more often, I put myself in the place of the main character, as many of us probably do, and again, I think, what would I have done? Would I have acted in the correct manner? I don't know. And so that's kind of how I approach some of these things. Man, Saul, that was so dumb. And then I think, that might have been me. That might have been me doing that dumb thing. So turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 9. And we'll refer back to that passage where he's still looking for the herds. And at this point in his life, if Saul ever was saved, he definitely wasn't saved yet. And if he wasn't saved, he certainly wasn't called by God yet. But I still think there's some lessons to learn here. And if you look in this chapter, and you look in, especially in verse 6 and then later in verse 18, Saul has absolutely no idea about Samuel, which is remarkable when you go throughout the book of 1 Samuel, because it's about God leading the Israelites through the man of Samuel. And Samuel's done many great things. He's interceded for the Israelites. He's prayed for them before the Lord. He's their spiritual leader. He's been brought up there since the time of a child. He's a prophet. He doesn't live that far from Saul geographically. And even in the passage, the servant knows about Samuel. But Saul seemingly has absolutely no idea about this spiritual leader of Israel. And then another thing that you don't see in these verses is you don't see Saul asking the Lord for guidance. He says, well, it says he looked here and he looked here and he's diligent and is looking and is searching, but we know we ought to be diligent in our prayer life as well. And here there's no evidence of that for Saul. But again, I don't think he's not saved here yet and he hasn't been called by God. So we might say, well, we'll cut the guy some slack. But now turn to 1 Samuel 13. 1 Samuel 13. And we're going to start in verse 5. And now by this point in Saul's life, he has been called by God. He has experienced the Lord's working. He's seen his power firsthand. And so that little bit of slack we might have cut him earlier, I don't think we can give him any more. But that's probably where a lot of us are. Most of us would say, well, God's worked in my life. I've seen his power work. I've seen him do amazing things. And so I think that's the mindset that maybe we should go into some of these passages. You know, we're like Saul in a way. But 1 Samuel 13 and verse number 5, we're going to read down through verse 14. It says, and the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and the people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and pitched in Michmash eastward from Bethaven. And when the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, verse 6, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves in caves and in thickets and in rocks and in high places and in pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. And as for Saul, he was yet in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. Verse number 8, and he tarried 7 days, according to the set time that Samuel had appointed. But Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. Verse number 9, and Saul said, bring hither a burnt offering to me and peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. And it came to pass that as soon as he had made an end of the offering, of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him that he might salute him. And Samuel said, what hast thou done? And Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash, therefore said I, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal. And I have not made supplication unto the Lord. I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering. Verse 13. And Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. But now the kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee. So this is a pretty well-known mistake in Saul's life. And the scene is set. The Philistines are coming, verse 5, as the sand which is on the seashore. And when you think about that, that'd be pretty terrifying. Verse 6, the men of Israel are fleeing, they're running, they're hiding. On every side, it seems Saul's already small army is fading away. And the ones that do continue to follow him, verse 7, are trembling. And so here Saul waits. And he waits for Samuel as he was commanded to do. And as he's waiting, you can almost see the panic setting in on his face. You know, boy, Philistines are right here. They're ready to attack and kill everybody at any moment. Samuel said he was going to be here today, and he hasn't showed up. And you can almost see the people around him going, what's he going to do? He's the king now. He's the leader. What's he going to do? And I asked myself, well, what would I have done in that situation? What would any of us have done? Well, we would have had the self-discipline to wait and say, no, the Lord's going to come. He's going to save us. I don't care about the thousands of people on the hill ready to kill me at any second. It's easy to say yes when you've never been in a situation. But then I think, well, what about our own lives when the problems are mounting and trouble or disaster perhaps seems imminent and the pressure is mounting to make a decision, to act? And well, what do we do? Do we make the decision in the heat of the moment, an emotional one? You know, or do we continue to wait on the Lord and just say, no, I don't feel comfortable about this. I need to wait on the Lord and his timing and his guidance. And I was thinking about this when I was putting this together, and I thought about that song, Simply Trusting, which we've all sang several times. And the chorus goes like this. You'll recognize it. It says, trusting as the moments fly, trusting as the days go by, trusting him whatever befall, trusting Jesus, that is all. Well, that's easy to sing when you're sitting in church in America. But I can imagine Saul, you know, hearing those words. You know, you got thousands, tens of thousands of people over there. Trusting as the moments fly, trusting as the days go by. Okay, well, day 1, 2, 3, 4 went by. So he's still trusting. Day 5, 6, Samuel's going to be here. He's going to be here. He's going to be here. I'm still trusting. Well, day 7 comes, and the moments are flying by. That's asking a lot. You know, am I going to trust? Am I going to wait it out till the end because I know the Lord's going to come through? And again, it's easy to do. It's easy to trust when life's falling into place, but you know, when life seems to come at you a little quicker and knocks you over, it's not so easy. But of course, here Saul fails to wait, and who shows up but Samuel as he's finishing up the sacrifice. And So now the man that was supposed to bring good news and encouragement and direction comes bearing tragic news. Saul, you messed up. Kingdom, it's gone now. It's going to cost you. There's consequences. That's one of the main themes, it seems like, in the book of 1 Samuel. There's consequences for your sin. And so I was thinking, you know, just like when we sin, our sin puts us at odds with God, costs us the heavenly kingdom. We're disqualified. Well, here Saul's sin separates him from God, and it costs him his earthly one. And he offers an explanation. Samuel says, "What hast thou done?" In verse 11 and 12, he starts offering an explanation. "Well, this is what I did." But it's too late. The sin's been committed. The damage is done. And you'll notice even when he's offering it, he condemns himself. In verse number 12, you know, Samuel confirms it's wrong. He says, "Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord." And I thought, well, maybe Saul didn't know. You know, maybe he thought, well, it's been day 7 and Samuel wasn't there yet. But then look at the end of verse 12. "I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering." And that, I think that implies a knowledge. There's some hesitation there. He knew it was wrong, but "I forced myself. I knew it was wrong. I shouldn't have done it." And I think, you know, how often do we do that sometimes in our own lives? Whether it's to someone else or in our own minds, we justify our actions and we explain away what we did, and it's so easy to just gloss over it. And we might not even think it's a very big deal. Well, it was in a time crunch. You know, I had no other choice. I didn't know what to do. But at the end of the day, sin is sin. And so, of course, that's one of Saul's first big mistakes. Turn to 1 Samuel 14, and we're going to start in verse 14. 1 Samuel 14, verse 14. We're going to read several verses here. And in verse 14 it says, "In that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within, as it were, a half acre of land which a yoke of oxen might plow." Verse 15, "And there was trembling in the host, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the spoilers, they also trembled. And the earth quaked, so it was a very great trembling. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, and they went on beating down one another. And then said Saul unto the people that were with him, Number now, and see who is gone from us. And when they numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. And Saul said unto Ahiah, the priest," he said, "bring hither the ark of God, for the ark of God was at that time with the children of Israel." Verse 19, "And it came to pass, while Saul talked unto the priest, that the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increased. And Saul said unto the priest, withdraw thy hand. And Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to the battle, and behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a very great discomfiture." And then skip down to verse 23. It says, "So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Bethaven." And in verse 24, "And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged on mine enemies. So none of the people tasted any food." And the main complaint here, as we go through, is Saul's foolish command to the people not to eat any food. And I think his idea was generally maybe an okay one. You can see the Philistines are fleeing, they're running, and I'm guessing his mindset is, let's not waste time eating dinner, let's finish this thing, let's wipe them out. God's already given us the victory, let's, you know, let's stay on it. But there's several issues with his order. A, the men are tired, they've already been running and hiding and chasing, and they're faint, they're in no condition to chase down the army. Second, the punishment here of eating when you're starving doesn't really seem to fit the crime, of eating doesn't seem to fit the punishment of death. That doesn't really seem to add up. Not everyone heard the command, at least Jonathan, his own son, certainly didn't. So then, of course, when they're finally allowed to eat, the people pollute themselves because they jump on the spoil, they're so hungry, and they just start eating, and they don't do it in a proper manner. They pollute themselves with the blood, which, of course, in the Old Testament was a big-time mistake. And so there's those problems there. And all that Saul thought, you know, that he was trying to do, we want to save time, we want to go after him, it's been completely defeated now because they have all these separate problems, and it defeats his original purpose. You'll notice in verse 18 and 19 that in all this noise and hubbub and what's going on, Saul asked the priest to come and to bring the ark, and there's a couple of different theories why he did that. The first is some people thought, well, maybe he was trying to encourage the people because the ark was a great symbol and it's powerful. And maybe, I don't think so, because the last time the Israelites did that, it was a huge mistake. They were absolutely slaughtered. The ark was taken and it was captured by the Philistines. But I think Saul's intention really was to consult God. And he thought, I got the priests, bring the ark. We'll talk to the Lord. And just as you're about to say, well, that's a good thing, what's he do? Well, at the very end of verse 19, what's he tell the priests? Hey, withdraw thine hand. Forget about it. Stop. You don't need that anymore. And it's like, I don't know if he was confused from the noise, or more likely, he sees that the Philistines are fleeing, they've been defeated, and what's he do? Hey, we don't need to go to God anymore. Withdraw your hand. Forget about it. And just like that, Saul's off. And I think, boy, even though it might not be the same situation, I know I've done that before. I think I've got this problem. I've got this concern. I had to pray about it. I asked the Lord for help. And then a problem gets alleviated, or for whatever reason, something else comes up and it kind of falls into the background and we don't think about it anymore. And suddenly it's no longer a priority to go before the Lord. My problem's gone. I don't need to ask God for help. And I don't need, and it never says that Saul thanked the Lord at this exact instance for giving him the victory. We do that all the time. Got a problem, God fixes it, forget to give him thanks. Or in our private lives, we think, I ought to study the Word of God, I ought to read the Word of God, I ought to go to the Lord in prayer, every day, and then some distraction comes up, something big, something small, and we think, God can wait, and we put it off. And, of course, that's not something we should aim for. In verse 36 through 46, we won't read them all, but what's going on here is the Lord is not responding to Saul's desire to ask him for help, and Saul senses that something's off in the nation of Israel, and so he looks around at everybody and he says, everybody gather, because we're going to figure this out. We're gonna find out who did something. And of course, it's found out that Jonathan unknowingly broke Saul's command not to eat. And in the name of justice, Saul almost comes very close to killing his son. A great injustice. And all the people say, whoa, 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 Saul, hold up. The Lord used Jonathan to provide this victory. You can't kill him. And they intercede. And that's, Jonathan was very fortunate that the people did that. But what's the problem there? Well, Saul, instead of examining his own life and looking at his inward heart, and looking at his own heart, he brings everyone else. Where's the problem? We're going to figure this out. Another thing we do all the time. Something must be amiss. Who did it? I bet it was them. What did they do now? Why can't they just mind their own business? Why can't they just, do what they're told? And we never look at our own heart, or we rarely look at our own heart. Sometimes, I know in my life, and look and say, well, what have I done? Have I done everything to, make sure that I'm not causing a problem? And Saul doesn't do that. Look at verse 36 of chapter 14, verse 36. It says, and Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and spoil them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them. And they said, do whatsoever seemeth good unto thee. Then said the priest, let us draw near hither unto God. So Saul's ready to capitalize on God's good fortune. The victory's been won. Philistines are on the run. And let's go get them. Let's go. Let's finish them. But what does the priest say? Hold up. Let's go to the Lord. Let's talk to God about this. And of course, that should have been Saul's first thought. He's the leader of the nation. He's the king. But again, we do it all the time. I got to do this. I got to take care of this. I got to figure this one out. It's so easy to forget to stop and pray. And hopefully we have friends and people in our lives that would say, hey, have you prayed about this? Have you gone to the Lord? Have you asked him for guidance? And of course, that's what the priest does. Turn to 1 Samuel 15 now. 1 Samuel chapter 15. I'm going to start in verse 3 and then read verse 13 through 15. And so we could talk about a whole lot of Saul's errors. There's a lot of them. Whether it was his failure to lead the Israelites against Goliath, or when he's trying to chase David all those times and kill him, and of course his life just becomes one of bitterness, or when he attempts and he goes and seeks out the witch of Endor,
to bring back Samuel, or at the end of his life when he opts for suicide because that's his best option. But we're not going to look at those. We're going to look at this one because I think this is a very, it seems like this is a big turning point in Saul's life. Up till now, you know, there's been some problems, there's been issues, but now it really seems after this moment, it's a downhill spiral. And so look at verse 3 of chapter 15. This is the Lord speaking, and he says, "Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not. But slay both man and woman, infant and a suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." Verse 13. "And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said unto him, Blessed be thou, O the Lord, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. And Samuel said, What meaneth then this bleating of the sheep in mine ears, and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." And then skip down to verse 20. "And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and have gone the way which the Lord sent me, and have brought Agag the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the spoil sheep and oxen, the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice unto the Lord in Gilgal." So what does Saul do here? He disobeys a direct order. We've all done that. I remember one time as a kid, I obeyed a direct order from my dad, and I paid the price dearly. He said, don't do this thing, and ignored it. And let's just say that was the first time I got it with a belt. And that's what Saul does here. He directly disobeys. There was no confusion here. The Lord said, do this thing, and he doesn't do it. And then on top of that, not only does he disobey, he does something that's, very shameful. He deflects the blame to everybody else, onto the people he's supposed to be leading. Verse 15, he says, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen. And then he tacks on there to sacrifice to the Lord. And then he includes himself in the little part that was done right. He kind of includes himself in that. Verse 15, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. Verse 20, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. And then in verse 21, but the people took of the spoil which should have been destroyed. He deflects all the blame and all the wrongdoing onto everybody else when he was the one who gave the commands. He was the one leading the charge. And then he includes himself in the part that's actually done right. And again, I think, how easy is it for us to do that? When something's not done right, there's a mistake, maybe willful sin, someone confronts you about it, it's found out that there's something done incorrectly. Oh, yeah, I don't know what they were doing. That was them. I don't know. That's just kind of what happened. Rather than taking responsibility for our own actions. Yeah, I messed up. I shouldn't have done it. Or, I spaced. I forgot. But it's easy to do that. Or to take the praise and the accolade and the applause when something's done right. Oh, yeah, that was me. It's easy to do that, but it's not easy to accept responsibility when you're wrong. And Saul fails to do that. So I think, well, where does that leave us? That's a little bit of Saul's legacy. Started okay, and in all these places where he failed and he messed up. And again, as I read through those, I think it would have been so easy to make some of those same mistakes to in what you in your own mind think, yeah, that seems like a good idea, and then to just completely, to miss the mark. Well, I think Pastor, on Sunday, he made a great point. Turn to Proverbs 3. And as he was preaching, I thought, man, what better of an application than for King Saul and turn for us when we're faced with decisions that we're not exactly sure how to act. And like Pastor always says, they're guidelines, not guarantees. But just look in the first six verses of Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse number 1, it says, "My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee." And I know the Proverbs wasn't around when Saul was, but, Saul, it was very clear. You kept not the commandment of the Lord. Length of days wasn't something he was blessed with. His reign certainly wasn't one you could describe with peace. Verse 3, let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck. Write them upon the table of thine heart. So shalt thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of both God and man. Early in his life, Saul was a merciful man. He was acting on truth. And later in life, he completely forsook those things, and he reaped the rewards of that. Verse 5, trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. Well, what was Saul's main fault? What's one of our main faults? We trust in our own ways. We lean on our own understanding. It's easy to do that. It's not always so easy to go to the Lord and allow him to direct our paths. And of course, Saul's paths are not made straight. His life is a very difficult one. And then verse 11 and 12, my son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as a father and his son whom he delighteth. So I say, well, what would I say to King Saul? What would I say to myself? What would I say to us when we're in those positions? Well, first, obey God's commandments. Obey the word of God. That should be a no-brainer. And then second, like Pastor's been saying it for the last few weeks, seek wisdom. It's out there. What did he say? God, he's willing to give it, and there's no limits. There's no limits that God's willing to give us in wisdom. And that's what we need when we're coming to these decisions. That's what Saul needed when he was coming to some of those points in his life where he didn't know what he was doing. He made the wrong decision. He should have asked the Lord, give me wisdom before I act. He shouldn't have rushed. And that should be our prayer, is that the Lord would give us wisdom so that we don't make some of the same mistakes that Saul makes.